You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My guest for episode 230 is singer-songwriter guitarist Dean Wareham. He was born in New Zealand, but then moved to New York City still as a child and went to school with his future Galaxy 500 bandmates. You're right now hearing the song Strange from their second album, On Fire, 1989. After releasing three albums, 88 through 90, Dean broke up that band and started his own, Luna, which released seven studio albums before breaking up in 2005. He has since released five albums as Dean and Britta with his wife, Britta Phillips, who was in Luna playing bass for their last couple of albums. He released his first album under his own name in 2013 and has now just released his fourth, That's the Price of Loving Me. We're going to talk about the song We're Not Finished Yet from that album. Then look back to Love is Colder Than Death from that first solo album, Emancipated Hearts. Then look back to 23 Minutes in Brussels from Luna's 1995 album, Penthouse. And we'll conclude by listening to The Cloud is Coming, another from the new album. For more information, please see deanwareham.com. For more about this podcast, see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And to support the effort, get your episodes ad-free and get my detailed notes on these songs, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. I will play a little bit of Strange by Galaxy 500 from On Fire, their second album from 1989. We're going to get pretty quickly to the new stuff. I would normally ask for sort of an outline. How do we get from there to here? But I've just spent many days reading this Black Postcards, your memoir. So I at least know the story up to 2005, that we had a few Galaxy 500s, then reboot a Luna, a more maybe accessible project up to 2005, then doing things with your life partner, and now doing what, the fourth solo album here, right?
Yeah, I said 3.5.
Okay.
Because the first one was an 8-song EP, but whatever. 8 songs is an album these days.
Sure.
8 is the new 10.
Before we hear We're Not Finished Yet, the track you had picked from the new album, That's the Price of Loving Me, can you say a little about where you're at with this album, where you're at with this song before we hear it in full?
Actually, I wrote it about a guitar. It's quite a long story. So I think if when you first hear it, you're like, oh, this song sounds kind of filthy. I waxed you, I rubbed you, I reamed you, I cleaned you. I had read this French poem, and I don't read a lot of French poetry. It was in translation. It was called Un Bahut, The Cabinet. In it, the poet describes the act of polishing like a chest of drawers, a piece of furniture, and like waxing it, and how he used all his strength. And I waxed you and I polished you. And I was like, oh, that would be fun if I took that idea and wrote a song about this guitar that I had just bought. I had gone to the Guitar Center. They had advertised this. They had this 1968 Gibson ES-335, and they dropped the price on it. This was in Hollywood, and I went in there up into the vintage room in the back. Somebody had it out on the counter, the sales guy and with another guy, and they were looking at, they had the pickups out of it. They were like going over every little detail of it. And I said to Britta, just be quiet, we'll just wait over here. And then after about half an hour of waiting, the guy was like, oh, I'm going to think about it, I'll come back. And I walked over to the salesman and I, did he put down a deposit on that? And he said, no. I said, I'm buying it right now. So I took his guitar, and apparently the guy came back half an hour later wanted to buy it, but... Anyway, I got it home, and it was kind of scratched up. Someone had put the wrong tuning pegs in it, so I had to put new pegs in, and I had to ream it. So, and that actually is a thing. So you got to have a reamer to make the holes bigger.
All right, well, let's hear this ode to the guitar in full.
I hauled you from Hollywood back to the show. I waxed you, I rubbed you, I gave you a glow. Play for me, darling, and do not forget. We're not finished now, we're not finished yet. Your trapeze and your tulips, your tuning machine. Ask me my name, I tell you it's Dean. So pray for me, darling, and do not forget. We're not finished now, we're not finished yet. I sanded your saddle, I polished your frets. I reamed you, I cleaned you, I have no regrets. Play for me, darling, and do not forget. We're not finished now, we're not finished yet.
So I was really happy you picked this one, because this kind of stood out to me when I was listening to the whole album, this really nice waltz, you know, sort of Baroque thing, not what you're known for.
Yeah. Well, I should mention, so the other element, there's kind of a French thing going on here. I took the waltz and the chord structure from this unreleased Serge Gainsbourg track. It's just, he performed it once on TV. It's on YouTube, but it's never on any of his records, a song that he'd written about something floating down a river. Anyway, I changed the key. You're allowed to do that. You're allowed to take chords. You're still allowed to do that.
Oh, sure.
As long as you write your own melody. And I think that's kind of the point of, you hear a song and you're like, that's really beautiful. What? I could cover that, or I could borrow certain elements and turn it into something else.
Well, you're giving credit right here. Here is the credit.
This is... I know. And it's not worth suing me, because I don't sell enough records. They go after you when you have a hit, you know, like the Tom Petty hit they went after.
Oh, I don't know if I heard that one. I mean, I certainly Stairway to Heaven and many that have traveled this road, which especially, you know, that you've got a pretty minimalist style. So, oh, those chords, like, well, we're going to get toward the end of the interview here, 23 Minutes in Brussels, which I kept wanting to go radio on, you know, because I know you're a Jonathan Richman fan. And like, of course, but like, it's a one in a, to four where, you know, it's
yeah, yeah.
You can't copyright.
No, that classic progression. Yeah.
Which in this one, every time you got the vocal line, then it answers, which it's a melody, I guess, but it's almost just like you're playing the chords and that's the answering melody. At what stage would that come? Would that be while you're coming up with it initially, or this is an overdub? Oh, that thing now that you're going to remember is this is a after the fact.
I think it's just on the basic guitar track. There's mm-hmm. that little picked thing that it kind of picks out the melody with the chords. Thing that changed in the studio is the end of the song, where all of a sudden we flip it and it's kind of going to a long outro, a jam over those two chords singing, we're not finished yet.
Yeah, I'm trying to look. This might happen with all three of the songs. Not as much on Love Is Colder, but this seems to be like part of your the shtick that you say in your book. Like, you know, one song you had just written the same verse. This is probably a Galaxy 500 tune that you just wrote the same verse and you just sang it three times and it was pretty minimal. And you're like, that's enough. That's, you know, what is the bare minimum that I can give you?
Sometimes it's enough. I mean, there's all kinds of ways that a song can be great. I mean, well, like Murder Most Foul by Bob Dylan, that, you know, or, you know, something with many, many verses. Or then sometimes there's something that's just like a haiku that's just a couple of words that repeat, like Tugboat by Galaxy 500. There's hardly anything in that.
Yes, I think that was the one that you were talking about. Okay, well, so saying this is a new guitar, the Ask Me My Name actually makes sense, because I was thinking this, the whole not finished yet thing, especially after reading the book and seeing the documentary and the whole thing about, oh, what a long journey I've had through music, but I'm still going to make another album. But this is a new accompaniment. This is not the guitar that's followed you year after year.
No, it's true. It's true. We're not finished yet. I mean, it can be read, as I said, as a love song too. So, you know, we're not finished yet. But yeah, and actually for one uncomfortable moment, I was like, is this like that Elton John song, I'm Still Standing? I don't know if you remember that.
Of course. I'm a child of the 80s, so yes.
Which we thought of as late Elton John, but in fact, it's early to mid-period Elton John.
I think you could still count. I think after a certain point.
Yeah, it all becomes late Elton John, Sir Elton, excuse me. Often a song is just, yes, it's all leading towards like a long outro, a section where you get to have fun.
We're adding a second guitar. The bass is jamming more. It's not like you're adding 12 layers of strings here.
There's not a whole lot in this one. It works with the space and the...
That I guess just going up in the vocal.
Yeah.
Yeah, just having that extra energy was enough that you didn't need to super orchestrate it.
Well, and then, and then for the outro, for the coda, it gets kind of, you know, as like a fuzz guitar solo. In fact, two of them are going at once. I think when we're in the studio, I probably would have just worked harder on one, but Kramer's like, no, we'll do two. Then you run them together and it sounds kind of cool that way.
And you mostly save the drums for the end, right? That you have them coming in and out and like, oh, it sounds like it's, oh, nope. No drums yet. We're going to do another verse here.
Yeah, the drums are like barely there for most of the song. There's a few songs like that on this new record where it's just play it like percussion, like it's hardly there at all, which is nice. Then you can hear the vocal better.
So the guitar sounds themselves, you have one of your standard sounds. And then just right from the beginning, you've got this, I put horn-like. Do you even remember sort of what is providing this?
You know, I had this weird reverb pedal that's on the guitar that's making a very strange, I don't know, it's just an odd kind of otherworldly reverb that's just called the hypersleep pedal.
Okay. And as far as the lyrics, like, were you going back and, like, some of these, I didn't look up all these, but I've messed with enough guitars, so I know where the saddle is. But, like, the tulips, is that, like, an actual part of the guitar?
Well, yeah. Tulip-shaped tuning pegs. They're like a tulip shape. It's your trapeze, because this guitar has a trapeze on it instead of a stop tail. This is guitar nerd stuff.
That's what I was wondering, if you were just doing that all from your experience and looking at this guitar, or whether you're like, okay, now I've got something. Let me look up what are the weirdest sounding... Let's do some Googling to see.
The line that I'm proudest of is your parallel inlays of polymer pearl. Well, they're like laid into the neck of polymer. It's like a fake plastic mother of pearl. So it's not real mother, but it's...
So that's an actual thing on this guitar, not, let me just use alliteration. So it makes it harder that you're using alliteration on an actual, you know, not just from your imagination, you know, as if this were an exercise, put an object in front of you and be poetic about it.
It took a while to write this one. Yeah, it really did. So I just kept going back and tweaking it. But it's kind of easier when you just come up with an idea. Like I mentioned, here's this poem about a cabinet. I'm going to do one about this guitar. It's kind of that if you give yourself a task, it kind of makes it a little easier.
So you're saying you're reading French poetry, but normally don't do that. So this is one of the kinds of literary exercises that you do to drum up new things to write about?
Yes, yes, I will once in a while. I'll just pull out an anthology of poetry, or, I mean, we'll talk about it later. Actually, like, children's poetry is often, I think, a good source because it's simpler. Either written by children or written for children.
Mm. Yes, by children is fascinating. What's that about? You just referred in your book a bunch of times to it sort of being a struggle to write lyrics, which for somebody who seems to have literary education, like I wasn't sure if you're like struggling to get something primal. That seems like a little difficult, that either it's primal and it's there or you're fussing with it and it's not primal.
Yeah, I don't know why. Some weeks it's easy. And then sometimes you just like, I have nothing and there's nothing to write about, which is absurd because there's so many things to write about. But
play for me, darling, and do not forget. We're not finished now. We're not finished yet.
So this song has, it doesn't really have a chorus. It has a refrain.
Yeah.
Like if you look again at Bob Dylan, very rarely does he write a chorus. It's more like a hard rain's going to fall. It's just like this line that keeps coming back at you. That's another trick.
Well, and where to put that? Because often the refrain is like most of the time you start the song off with it. You know, it's the thing that is leading off every line. Here it's, you've got your nice verse and this is the thing. You know, I just written it as the second half of the verse, but it's just spilling you to another verse that it doesn't, you know, that is as close as to a resolution, a nice chorus as you're going to get.
Yeah, it does resolve right before going into the outro. It does kind of resolve.
And then just this, how you're going to get from that back to the verse.
We're not finished yet. Your trapeze and your...
Let me write a guitar line or something. Like, it has that lullaby quality to it.
I don't know the rules. I don't know how to, I don't understand songwriting. I just, and no one's taught me how to do it properly. I just... do it. I think the same for most of us.
Yeah. I'm always just interested in how much do you second guess yourself? How much is it, you know, oh, maybe there was a riff there and actually we don't need that. Let's just pull that out because it sounds like it's just a nice, simple transition. Like, but it sounds like that was plan A.
That's true. It was plan A. Sometimes Britta helps me with these things too. She'll be like, this is like dull. It just keeps doing this. You need to throw in a chord here or there, come do something different with it, or I might change the key. God forbid.
Yes, I think after the second one, well, I had written Tom Hits, so you must have a little more ornamentation that because this is going to happen multiple times.
It picks up a little, but honestly, we've been rehearsing this song, and I will kind of, because it's four verses, and we're kind of like, do we need to build a little more? Is it dull the way it is? Or?
Always the challenge, especially if you write something that has the many verses, that unless it is so hypnotic that it's, you know, like an old English ballad that you could just do 20 verses and be fine because that's the groove you're in and people are listening to the lyrics. But if it's a normal song.
I mentioned Serge Gainsbourg as well. And again, this is another songwriter who he does not write the chorus usually, or he doesn't go to a bridge. He doesn't change. He just would try and create a track so hypnotic that it would just kind of work the whole way through.
Where we're getting into that repeated, we're not finished now, which is... if it gets hypnotic, here's where it does it.
We're not finished now. We're not finished now. We're not finished now.
I need to practice that part.
Well, so which of the guitars are you? Did you have a two guitar lineup, I assume?
Yeah, I've got a two guitar lineup, so we're both going to have to be soloing on that.
You just count on the bass to hold down the...
Yeah, we made the record so quickly that sometimes I, when I go back to listen to it, I'm like, what the hell was I playing? What am I doing? Anyway, I'll figure it out.
Yeah, I really like the interaction that, you know, one is moving down a little faster than the other.
Yeah, one of them's doing a run going ascending and the other one's descending and And it's a long fade.
Yes. How are you determining, like, when you're actually laying this down? Had you practiced, I assume you hadn't practiced it with a band yet.
No, we really hadn't practiced it with the band because Anthony LaMarca, who played drums on that, he didn't practice any of the songs with us. He just showed up that day and played. And I was just like, I'll just play it for a while. We're going to fade it out. But Kramer kept that, when he did the mix, he kept it going all the way to the end.
So that actual sustained feedback thing that actually ends the song, you did not think that that was... going to be anything people would hear. You thought the song was going to be gone before that.
I didn't play it there. I played it somewhere else and he moved it there.
Oh, okay.
In the mix. He's did that a few times.
When the drums open up, well, it's just a very light little jazz thing. And that's the climax because you've had basically no drums before that.
Then it turns into a rock song a little bit anyway.
A rock song with a very nice little shuffly ride cymbal.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's get the second song out there so we can compare and contrast Love is Colder Than Death, the first song from your first solo album, Emancipated Hearts, 2013. Of course, you'd had a solo song way back in the latter Galaxy days and some of the Dean and Britta stuff. I mean, how different was a solo album from many of the things you'd done before?
Yeah, not that different. Okay. because as opposed to a Dean and Britta record, it's not that different anyway, because Britta's always very involved. And
yeah, do you want to say anything about where you're at this point, 2013-ish, and this song before we hear it?
2013, yeah. So I was just about to move to Los Angeles. I hadn't moved here yet, but I met Jason Cuiva from Papercuts. Band Papercuts, and he's like, oh, if you ever want to make a record, I produce stuff too. And I was like, oh, okay. So I went into the studio with him and Britta and Anthony LaMarca. It's the same drummer who we were just talking about. Anthony plays in the War on Drugs now, but Britta and I hired him when he was 19 years old and the student at the jazz program at the New School in Manhattan. Love is Colder Than Death. The title is from a Fassbinder film, not one of his better films, I don't think. It's kind of a film noir, Love is Colder Than Death. A good title is helpful. I think John Fogerty says you need three things in a song. One, you need a title, you need a riff, and I forget what the third thing is. So they go.
You need royalties that are negotiated fairly.
Yeah.
Far, they said.
Well, it doesn't actually have much of a riff in terms of just, it's those chords.
No, I took the riff out of it.
Okay.
To tell you the truth.
All right. So I was not hallucinating that this does happen, that you like the simplicity. And if it just seems like it's enough, let it be.
Yeah, because this song is based on another French song called La Fin de l'été, The End of the Summer, which was recorded by Françoise Hardy, which is kind of the version that I was going off, but also by Brigitte Bardot, a really nice version of it, written by a couple of French guys. Anyway, I liked the Françoise Hardy version. It has a cool little piano riff. I could send you the demo I made of it, which actually does have that little piano riff still in it.
Is it the same riff that comes in later, toward the end of the song?
No, it's not. I don't think it comes in at all. I just go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It's very French sounding.
And the choice to have that spaghetti Western, I'm sure it's not actually a baritone guitar, but so we're playing that, I'm going to play whole notes on parallel octaves or something. Sort of like I'm doing an extra bass part on guitar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's Jason Cuever who produced it. That's very him. He likes to play these clean lines. So he added that.
And so you said this started with the title, right?
I got the title, Love is Colder Than Death. And I've got the chords from a French song. And then I mentioned children's poetry. There's a poem called The Jumblies by Edward Lear, you know, the famous limerick writer.
Okay.
And again, this is in the Penguin Book of Nonsense Verse or something, which I love. It's a great, the song is about the Jumblies who go on a trip. They sailed away in a sieve. I think there's something in there too about when they come home, they'll say, oh my, how tall you've grown, which so I borrowed that line, but it's, you know, it's in the public domain, so I'm allowed to do that.
Okay. So the cats and mices have their vices. This was where your headspace was at, that would come out, because that's sort of a different, coming from a different place than the first verse, for instance, which sounds vaguely autobiographical, again, reading it through the lens of...
I know, well, yeah, the sky is dark, the trip was dark. But here's the other thing. So, yeah, so the song is about a voyage, about going away for a voyage and then coming home. But, and then I never really actually listened to the lyrics of La Fin de l'été, but that then I actually checked it out earlier today, just for interest, and I looked it up. And that is also about traveling. I have traveled wide and far. I've seen other beaches and forgotten them all. So... somehow that made its way.
To live so fast and feel so strong, but why can't I have mine? So this is not a fast song. Just the fact that, just that contrast.
To live fast, though, you know, that's a different thing, isn't it? I don't know. I don't know where I got that from. Live so fast and feel so strong.
I mean, do you think about, obviously some songs are like, this is a love song. This is aimed at somebody. What is the position of the narrator here, or is it just words?
To me, this song feels like I wrote it for my son. I know you're not supposed to say that in rock and roll.
After a certain age, I mean, you really should. You're not writing about hitting on.
I mean, just a lot. Every time I sing 10 years on, because I mean, I moved out to California because my son had moved out here. He was 13 and my ex-wife moved out here with him. And then we came out here too. And so for me, that's part of what it's about, is that travel. And then 10 years on, we'll all come home and they'll say how tall you've grown.
And yet love is colder than death. Yeah. So I thought that the initial thing is, yeah, because it seems like if you start with that title and you can read that, the reason it's resonant is because you can read all the times where you made a decision for love that ends up hurting somebody else. And yeah, that's the rules of the game.
Yeah.
And that's what it sounds like in the first line, is that, you know, I had the rock and roll lifestyle and I met my second wife on the road and
yeah.
That kind of thing.
It's true.
But then, you know, that you abandon that. The second verse, are you dark or are you fair? Do you sit on stool or chair? Which almost sounds like the previous song. Are you a girl or are you a boy? Asking the guitar here.
Well, I think that's from an old English children's poem too. Or do you sit on stool or chair?
So there's no actual literal significance in terms of guitarists or whatever.
No. This is like a therapy session. It's good. We're really getting into it here.
You know, it's very rare when somebody has a complete plan, but at least, you know, we can make stuff up after the fact. Why did we make that choice? Well, I don't know.
It's true. But I think that's a good point, though, that it's I mean, sometimes there's a plan. Like I said, with that other song, I had a plan to write a song about this guitar. Mm-hmm. But often there just isn't. You're just like trying to piece things together, and there's multiple sources for different parts of the song, even for the lyrics. And then you look at it at the end and like, well, hopefully this all makes sense. And if it doesn't, well.
So how about this as an example of your increasing affection for country music? That I know you did the whole country covers album not too long ago, and this definitely has that sort of feel. Although I wasn't sure with these trill strings that they're so prominent throughout, if that was also just the producer's choice or if that was...
That was the producer's choice. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think of it as country just because there's a lot of chords in it. And maybe the title's kind of country too. I mean, country songs have great titles. What does they say? Country songs are about defeat, whereas rock and roll songs are about...
We are the champions.
Yeah, I think that's kind of true. I'd rather be picked up somewhere else than put down at home. There's that break. It happens like three times in the song, but each time it gets longer. So each time it's teasing it. When we come to play this song live too, we're like, how many do we do it this time? So we do it, I think, just once and then four times. And then finally at the end, it's like this long, just hanging out on this G chord for a long, long time until we finally go back into an extended chorus as well with Britta's backing vocal. And
yeah, so what about the having Britta wait until the end, you doing your own... Is it just you wanted to do a little high harmony, or is that somebody else still singing?
No, I guess Britta's always doing the harmony. I mean, I do often do a high harmony.
It sounds like you are until the end, that love is cold, that you're just doing this little tiny voice. Unless that's, I don't know, one falsetto sounds much like another.
Yeah.
If that was the producer chiming in or something. Okay, so you have no particular thoughts of what, that you're gonna save her till the end, so she's doing the third part.
Well, she's good at doing harmonies, the thing is, which I'm useless at. I struggle with it. When we come to do these things live, it's better if I can't hear anyone or anyone else singing. They'll just throw me off.
And that goes on. So yeah, you have a few different elements. So Britt is playing the bass, right? Are you coaching her on, oh, why don't you jump up there now? Or are you just sort of letting her feel?
I don't coach people. I wouldn't know how. I have to surround myself with people who are better musicians than I am.
So are the strings totally a production after effect on this whole thing? Because it's a strange combination of, I'm going to do this very minimal piano part that's sort of a non-piano player doing a thing next to this virtuoso violin who's doing... That's a very strange...
Yeah, and also Jason Quever's playing... Well, it's like a string sound on his keyboard. He has an Nord keyboard. So it's a vibrato, a tremolo string.
Oh, okay. So that's mostly keyboard until she actually pops out.
So there's keyboard, but then the viola or violin, I can't remember which it is. Or maybe it's both, because Jillian, who played that, she was amazing. She's a great musician. When you bring in a string player, they kind of make it sound classier. They make it sound like you know what you're doing.
Yes, I have a very minimalist song that, in fact, I wrote when I was like 17, and I've done several versions of it. And I have a relative who's a concerto oboe player, and like, oh,
yeah.
Wait a second. Oh, that now it's classy. Now it's a whole extra thing. How do we actually end the song? I think this one does fade out. It's
We did most of that in the studio, the live viola and violin. We had Jimmy came over to Britta in my apartment in Brooklyn, and she overdubbed that, and I sent the tracks back to Jason. I'm remembering that now.
So is that very last guitar thing, is that something you were sort of jamming on throughout that you just kind of pulled up in that section, or was that a...
I'm just wandering around there at the end.
I mean, is that part of the procedure if you're recording in an environment where you're not, you know, doing live with a band or something, that to let me just noodle around a bunch of times? I know you talked about Sean doing this ad nauseum, but like, let me just do the solo a few times and, you know, maybe we'll pick the good parts. Or what's your general when you're recording a solo of yours?
Yeah, do the solo a few times and pick the good parts is a good way to go, I think.
Or leave them all, if the case may be.
I mean, sometimes I know exactly when I'm playing something melodic.
Sure.
I like to play something melodic on the guitar. I don't really want like to just shred. I guess I do a little bit of slow shredding.
The piano in this, is that you tinkering around or is that the...
No, okay. Britta played the piano. I mean, I play the piano very badly.
It sounds unintentional, the solo that you have there. You know, it definitely sounds like it's a little wandering.
Britta plays some piano, but I kind of like, you know, one note at a time, primitive, like simple piano. The piano is an instrument you really got to watch out for because it can destroy your song quite easily. It's a dangerous instrument.
Mm-hmm. Hearing why did Peter Buck switch to mandolin? Like, because I wanted to be in a place where I didn't know what I was doing.
Oh, interesting. Is that what you're saying?
As well, that, you know, getting back to the primitivity. In fact, you refer to another band that just not only was punk and couldn't really play their instruments, but would pass them around constantly as if like the only authenticity could come when you really don't know how to play.
Yeah,
that you're literally exploring new ground in just what happens when I. Are you so automatic on guitar that there's nothing that is a mystery anymore in terms of...
No, I'm not automatic at all. Especially on some of these songs that have a lot of chords. And I haven't really practiced the solo when we go into the studio. So I often get lost. Certainly in the making of this new record, there's a couple of times where I'm like, what? Where is it going here? But it's good to be lost sometimes in the song. And, you know, that's... Because sometimes the wrong note is more interesting than the right note on... I read that Alex Chilton had this trick, that thing he liked to do, which he would take a song, he would mute all the tracks and then just put down like a keyboard on it. He would know what key it was and just play something, some wandering thing, without listening to anything else that was going on. And then when he's finished, then turn it back up and then just listen for those spots where actually something that wasn't intended for here, so where it actually sounds good. So
that sounds like a much cheaper way, a more efficient way than like, you know, the Beatles or, you know, let's find an appropriate little piece of the radio or whatever that we can put on here. Like, no, just do it yourself.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, pull from another song, do something. I guess it's much easier in the digital age to,
yes, it is.
Pull in, play that solo from the other song. Just put it on top of here. What will happen then?
Do it backwards.
Is it psychedelic enough now? Yeah, so I guess this was another one of how crazy is it going to get, that you've got the strings are bringing it up to an extra level of psychedelia, and certainly there was room here to have it go on longer, but this one is not, you know, the 6-minute one. It's pretty efficient that you get out without 20 seconds or something.
And we've got them. We just keep saying, love is colder, love is colder, love is colder. Again, like just kind of teasing. How long is this going to happen until it ends? And I'll tell you, it happens 7 times and then it ends.
Because you've been working this back up with the live band.
Yes.
So everybody has to count it. Yes. And the fact that you eventually, now we have in the last delivery of that, you're back to the major key.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we end up with a little nice warm hug.
Yeah. The song is in C sharp, I think, just because I happen to have a capo on it.
Well, let's get the third song out there where we're talking about songs that eventually meander around. Well, 23 Minutes in Brussels from your 1995 album Penthouse. I've listened to, you know, several live versions of that, and I know this is sort of a set closer. This was at least the closer for your very last Luna show before the Reformation.
I think it was.
In the movie. They start out the movie with a live version of this.
Oh, yeah.
And then wrap up. Say a little about, we're just going to hear the original version, which now it seems like, what? It doesn't have the Brit harmony. It doesn't have some of the elements that seem like they grew. But no, let's hear the original one, because this does have some interesting studio layers and things. But yeah, say a little where you're at with this 1995 album and this song here before we hear it.
This is the Luna's Penthouse album, our third album, which I guess most people consider this our best album. Recorded in Manhattan at a studio called Sorcerer and with guest guitarist Tom Verlaine of Television.
Okay. I didn't clock that exactly where. It doesn't sound like on this version you're doing any of the solos. I know on the live you start out soloing, but it...
I think I played right at the top of the song was a little...
Okay.
So, yeah. But yeah, most of the lead on there is Tom Verlaine, yeah.
Thank you.
That's me playing that little. Yeah.
Then you're just chugging. And it has a very Velvet Underground rich. They hit on some formula where you could have a song go on for 40 minutes and.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it would try some people's patience, but you know, I guess if you're on the right drugs.
Yeah. I think at a certain point, they got tired of playing super long songs like that. They did like a 36 minute version of Sister Ray, after the second album. And I think after that, well, then they split with John Cale. And I think Lou Reed sort of decides, oh, that he wants to put the focus back on the songs. But they still would whip that out once in a while, maybe when they were angry.
Right. Is that the Warhol influence of, you know, you can film someone sleeping, you can.
Yes. Don't be afraid to bore people. Warhol is not afraid to bore people. You know, there's another version of this. I think it's called 24 Minutes in Brussels, isn't it? Because originally the song was a bit longer. It was about a minute longer. And Tom Verlaine was like, I think this could do with an edit. We gave him a choice of songs to play on, but we played him a few things that we were doing in the studio. He was like, oh, I like this one, but it's a lot to ask someone to just play for like a solo for four straight minutes. But
even though you complain in the book about initially having group credits on songs, it looks like you kept doing that most of the time, at least in Luna. At least this is credited to all four of you on wherever I looked.
Oh, yeah. I don't object to having group credits, just for like what the percentages are exactly. I think it's
so. Were there financial discussions about that's one? You go into a lot of business stuff in the book, but I didn't notice specifically. You said stuff like Stan was not a full member because he wanted to be paid a salary. But in terms of these divisions, is it like, oh, well, I own 19% of the song and you own 23%? Like,
well, there's the song and there's the recording. It's two different things. Okay. But yeah, I mean, usually in a band, there's a formula like, well, okay, if someone's written the lyrics and the melody, they get someone's written the song.
Right.
They get a bigger cut of it. I am of the opinion, though, that, you know, if you're kind of working out the song together, then everyone who's in the room has a hand in writing. So everyone gets some kind of percentage in it.
But never group lyrics. I forget what other band you referred to. Like, oh, Metallica.
Oh, Metallica.
You referred to like them actually going through.
I did say that sounds like torture. I think maybe the Bee Gees wrote lyrics like that too. I think sometimes they just like, what are we going to say here?
Or at least as quality control. Like, okay, I wrote something. Let's go through it. If you can come up with a better line than that.
But I mean, here's what I would say about this song is that like as a song, I don't think it's that great. It's all about what the musicians do in the room. It's all about the playing. So it's like a really cool bass line from Justin. And
well, you rhymed city with sitting pretty. So there, that's probably.
Yeah.
It's a most beloved song. That's fine.
Let's go back to the title, 23 Minutes in Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
I was over at Howard Thompson's house. Howard was the head of A&R at Elektra Records when we were signed there. And he's an English fellow. But before coming to Elektra, he'd been at Columbia. He signed Psychedelic Furs. And before that, in England, he had signed Suicide, the band Suicide, to a subsidiary of Ireland called Bronze Records. He was a big Suicide fan. And he played me this at his house. He had this bootleg called 23 Minutes in Brussels. It's a bootleg recording of Suicide opening for Elvis Costello in the late 70s.
I'm sure the Elvis fans loved that.
They hated him. They hated Suicide. They got booed off the stage. Someone stole his microphone. So there's long people like, give me back my microphone. It just descends into chaos, which I think often happened to them. Like Suicide opened for Elvis Costello. They opened for the Cars and just people hated
them. I know Rick Ocasek was like a big supporter of them.
Oh yeah. You can hear it in what the Cars are doing. Absolutely. So that's kind of what the song's about. 23 minutes in Brussels. Why can't they just leave us alone? Are we going to get into a tussle? Can I take an airplane home?
Yeah. So Life on the Road, it seems there are quite a few songs that touch on that, given how much time you were spending on that. Let me play a little of the chorus where we get a little synth. We get some ahs here.
Tell me, do you miss me?
Ah. Actually, I don't know why I'm referring that to the chorus. The chorus is clearly the say a prayer part, but this is sort of a chorus too, post-chorus.
So I think, again, say a prayer, tell me, do you miss me, is the refrain.
Sure.
And actually the chorus doesn't have any vocals in it, but I do think of that as the chorus, that part that goes,
That's almost a car song, that little part there.
But sometimes there's a little short thing like that, and you're like, oh, I've got to write some words. And it's like, no, it's too short. There's nothing sensible you can say. You'll just make it dumber if you try and put words in.
Here in Brussels.
Yeah. So just don't do it. I think I mentioned that in the book too, that there was song, like the song IHOP, we tried to go back in after, because we're like, it doesn't have a chorus. How can this be the single at radio? Doesn't it? We tried to put it in a chorus. So I didn't. I'm now laughing now because I remember what I came up with for the chorus for this song, IHOP. I had just watched the documentary about Muhammad Ali and George Foreman, the fight in Zaire. And somehow I had this clip of Muhammad Ali talking to Howard Cosell, and he's like, your hair is a phony. You took from a pony. And that, I tried to insert that into this song.
So we have this fresh in our heads. We can picture that instead of the Oz.
Doesn't work. Better to just say,
And so it's Tom Verlaine. Where, I don't know if I can figure out exactly where. I'd have to listen for the styles and like, oh, that sounds like Tom Verlaine playing as opposed to Sean.
Yeah, you could tell. What's amazing about him as a guitar player, he didn't use any effects. It's just him, his fingers, and the volume knob on the Stratocaster. It kind of swells, so it kind of like, he attacks you with these notes, like they kind of swell up. I guess they'd all famously played the guitar in some ways more like a saxophone or something, like some other.
Well, let me play at least part of it from, so I'd written Middle Eastern flavor a la Paint It Black.
That's him. It still gives me chills hearing that. It was like, but you're right. It just have kind of like a Middle Eastern flavor to it. We asked him to do a lot. It was a long solo. He played it and he was like, oh, back me up just to this section and drop me in to just overdub a little bit. But he did it all very quickly and then suggested we do an edit, which was a good idea.
So then is there much Sean in here? Even though obviously he plays it a lot and uses this as like his canvas when you play this live.
Live as it always is. There's a few things in there that him does the little riff. Doom, 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 doom.
Sure.
Doom,
yeah. Doom, that doom. Initial.
I think he's playing that.
So it seemed like he was the guy that would investigate the pedals and be a little more ready for something with ring modulation or something crazy on that.
So I think we credited him on that record with guitar and tronics. Electronics. Yeah. In Luna. Sean's often, he's playing the fancier things often around. My playing's a little clumsier and his is more ethereal, perhaps.
Actually, I just written more clutter next to that because, you know, you're singing a whole thing.
I am also playing lead guitar at the end there. I come in with like a tune down, my E string down to a D, and it comes in with like wow, wow, wow. So, and that we do that live too. So at a certain point, we're both going.
Right. That even in this version, it sounds like you eventually just leave the bass covering the main riff, that you didn't, even though obviously you can overdub as much as you want.
Yeah.
You don't just keep chugging, that you eventually take off into the stratosphere as well.
It's a good bass line too, though.
All right, well, I guess you've answered the question as to how long do you let it go. It was apparently too long, such that, fixed it in post.
This is all on tape, but this is the olden days. In 1995, Mario Salvati, he loved to splice tape.
And had you been at this point working everything up live before going into the studio?
I don't think we'd play this song live before going to the studio, no.
Okay, so it was that we have a record to finish by deadline and we have to flesh these things out, not like we've been workshopping these for 4 months and then we record, because then it'd be very fast.
Yeah,
I guess that's how Galaxy 500 did it, right? Because you've been playing these before for the most part.
There's a couple songs that we played live for us before we did them in the studio, but we didn't make demos ever. I don't think at this point, actually, that Luna were making demos either. We were just jamming.
Sure. And again, the group crediting means that that's what you do when you make a record in the studio is you just, even if one or two people come up with most of the ideas, it's just too hard to track. And we're just going to be nice to everybody, the small amount of money that there is.
Well, like, look, I'm like, again, because I think back for this track, I don't think like hours spent in a basement in Hoboken jamming the song, because it's played these things over and over again until some kind of melody starts to come into my head and then I start singing. So If people are helping you do that, then they're helping you write the song.
All right. Well, to wrap up here, we're just going to introduce another song from the new album. The Cloud is coming, the closing track on there. I guess before we talk about that for a second, anything else? I know you're obviously promoting this new record. Is there already another one?
No, there's not.
Going? Have there been more reunions of the various bands? I thought I saw you were touring with Galaxy 5. Am I making that up?
No. Okay, no. I've done a tour where I play like a Galaxy 500 album. So.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm generally playing some of those songs when I play live now.
So you've made peace with everybody.
We get along fine on email.
Uh-huh.
We have stuff to do. It's like I tell people, it's like we got divorced, but we had these babies together. The babies are our albums that we made, and we need to check in on them now and then.
Sure. Are there other collaborations? Are there other things that are in various stages of completion?
A lot of touring about to happen. That's really the thing. The last collaboration we did a Christmas album, Britta and I, with Sonic Boom. Or should we call it a holiday album? Some of the songs are not about Christ. They're just about snow.
All right. So anything before we say goodbye that you want to say about The Cloud is Coming?
The Cloud is Coming. I wrote for the Noah Baumbach film, White Noise. It's on the soundtrack, a very different version. Britta and I perform it in the movie. We play a couple of 1980s hippies who are writing a song about, well, there's been a toxic spill and everyone's evacuated to this Boy Scout camp. And we're just writing a song about what's going on and all the rumors that are swirling about what's going on and what is the toxic cloud and what's the army doing. And Noah had suggested to me, he's like, well, go look at tabloids from the 1980s. Actually, they sent me some tabloid headlines from the 1980s and just think of it, just a song about paranoia. And there's a line in there about the East Germans putting a human brain into a chimpanzee. I like this song because the lyrics are kind of absurd, but still it's kind of moving. Just then the strings help with that too. Again, strings, the cello player who came and played on my new album is amazing. I don't know, it's got like an emotional kick to it, this song too. And The Cloud is Coming.
And is the acting thing an ongoing thing? I saw you're sort of associated with a few Noah Baumbach things.
He's the only person who casts me. He doesn't even make me audition. He's just like, I think you'd be okay for this. So, but I'm available for work.
All right.
I can play a cop, dentist, pediatrician, ayahuasca shaman. These are some of the roles he's kept. No, not as a cop, but ayahuasca shaman and pediatrician and hippie and music video director. These are some of the roles I've played for him.
All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this. Here is The Cloud is Coming.
Thanks, Mark.
The nighting dogs are here to stay. The government knows more than they say. UFO sightings in Farmington town. Widespread looting all around. Three live deer at the Kung Fu Palace are dead. Those pretty clouds ain't what they seem. How come I'm never in the mood? They're putting something in the cafeteria food. I see no difference between the blue and the red. The cloud is coming for us all. Can't you see those blinking lights? West of Sakhalin, a Su-15 had them in his sights. German shepherds from
Thanks so much to Dean. You can learn more about his work at deanwareham.com. I will again recommend his autobiography, Black Postcards. And from around the same time, 2006, there's also a full-length documentary about the last days of Luna. You can watch that in full on YouTube, and I have linked to it from the blog post associated with this at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. I hope you're subscribed to the Nakedly Examined Music podcast. Even if you are hearing this on the Partially Examined Life feed, say, you can get all the links to do that at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. However, the best way to do that is to go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, sign up for a very small per episode donation, and then you'll get the fully ad-free Patreon feed that you can also listen to through Spotify or any other podcast application you can install the feed on, which will let me know that you want this podcast to continue to exist. And in addition, from the Patreon post, you can get a link to my detailed notes on the episodes, the lyrics, the structures, the little things about the arrangements that you might not notice, many of which do not come up in the conversation. For my next episode, I am interviewing Bill Champlin from the Sons of Champlin, then from Chicago, and he has many solo albums, has co-written a couple Grammy-winning tunes, super competent guy. Hope you're having a good time as spring comes upon us here in the Northern Hemisphere. Keeping creative, checking out new music. Keep on musicking. Until next time, this is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.